Welcome back to Eldersight, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. This episode, we are continuing, I guess concluding, really, our coverage of The Wendigo by Algernon Blackwood, a novella he published originally in 1910.
The story comes to us by way of a Patreon supporter who nominated it and got it on the ballot, and you voted for it, so thank you. I think we both love this story. I'm really excited to talk about it. This is the second of two episodes. So if you've read this story and only want to listen to our discussion, that's fine. But I think we have some pretty good commentary. And Glenn did a great job of recapping it. That is kind of all in prep for the discussion. So listen to them both. I don't know. That's what I'm saying. If you haven't joined us on Patreon yet, you really should in order to vote for next year's themed stories. We talked a lot about that last episode. Some of them will, you know, one of the things on the ballot is whether Glenn or I will pick stories for the year. So we hope you'll join us on Patreon for voting and then also for the other excellent content we have on there that is not part of the main feeds.
Yeah, please do join us on Patreon to vote. You can do that at patreon.com/Clay Temple Media. And of course, there are other things on the ballot for next year, right? Pitting Brandon and I against each other is simply one of several options. Other option that might really appeal to people who are fans of this story is that we would cover stories with a similar setting. And naturally, then the next vote, if that were to win, the next vote in May could potentially have The Wilderness or The Woods or Canada, I suppose, as potential settings, right, to give us more of this and group stories together based on where they are set. Just another example of what is on the ballot. And yeah, as this episode is going out, I think we're a few days, maybe a week or so left in that first round of voting. So definitely not too late to get in on that, but the clock is ticking. So join us today to do that. All right, Brandon, let's get into this discussion. We teased a lot of it last time, and I think, as always for me when we do these big novellas, the real pressing question is, how do we get started here? There's so much to talk about.
There's so much. I hope I've structured our discussion, or at least outlined it in a way that will get us to most of what we teased in our recap episode, if not all of it. But where I want to start is really with the conceptual framework within which I want to begin to engage with this story, and that is with romanticism. And Glenn, I've realized, you know, as I sat down here to prepare, you know, notes for the discussion, that I don't think we've ever really done a full précis or primer on what romanticism is, but it's so important and so influential to weird fiction that I think we need to do that now. So that's what we're going to do. Romanticism, and really specifically British romanticism, is a term used to describe the artistic response to the high-minded rationalism of the Enlightenment, as well as an artistic reappraisal of the medieval period and also the poetic works of John Milton. All of this is combined with the consideration of the role that the individual played in the French and American revolutions, really throwing off the king, really the individual person's response or negation of the divine right to rule that kings had been claiming up until this point. So to give some rough dates, we are looking at the very late 18th century until, you know, maybe the middle of the 19th century, maybe before then. And, you know, one thing I just brought up here is that the Romantic movement considered individualism to be a heroic trait, strong enough in the case of Milton's Paradise Lost and the myth of Prometheus to rebel against God and the gods, that the individual is strong enough to cast off that sort of intellectual or superstitious framework. But also, Romanticism, the Romantics asked questions like, just what is an individual apart from society? Like, what is an individual if you leave them to be in a natural setting, like the woods or the forest or the sea? Like, what kind of nature do we have when we are not being pulled asunder by regular political upheavals that demand something from us, or by social concerns. And modernity or modernists would develop this theme into recognizing the way that the breakdown of institutions has fragmented our identities in some ways. But the stirring of these questions is here. Is there an original nature to man? These questions are being picked up and are much more seriously discussed in the middle of the 20th century. But another thing Romanticism sought to engage with was one's emotional reality, perhaps a reality that doesn't necessarily require one to disengage from reason entirely, or reasoning, logic, big concepts in the Enlightenment. But certainly, the Romantics wanted to allow one's emotions to speak to or to demonstrate, expose some kind of authentic experience of reality. And the stronger the emotion, the more worthwhile the experience was. Something like this is caught up in the German Sturm und Drang movement that was a precursor to Romanticism. But then you also see British Romanticism deal a lot with emotions of love, or even terror or awe. And these latter emotions, terror and awe, are specifically a part of the seeking out of the sublime. Now, this concept, the concept of the sublime, is a crucial one in Romanticism. It's a concept you can read a lot, and I recommend that you read a lot about, in Edmund Burke's text on the beautiful and the sublime. But basically, a sense of the sublime is something we get when we encounter something that our own reckoning obscures the fullness of from us. So maybe it is like a giant mountain, like, you know, the Alps that we see in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is one symbol of the sublime. Or maybe it's the exploration of an old medieval ruin, an abbey or a monastery or a castle that's got tunnels that lead to who knows where. And the potential for discovery is around any corner, as well as the potential to encounter something monstrous from the past. An encounter with the sublime, in other words, arrests our rational mind and engages directly with our emotions. And so, as I've been suggesting, the two places that Romantics thought we'd most encounter the sublime are in the depths of the natural world and in exploring also our ruined past, or the ruins of past civilizations. But, you know, this leads to a question maybe like, what is the dark side of Romanticism? And you may be thinking, you know, like, hey, humans don't only have positive emotions, like the sorts of strength of feeling we have when we fall in love or yearn for something deeply. You know, there has to be a dark side to all this romantic stuff. And there is. And that's what we get Gothic literature from. That's named for that medieval architectural style that was specifically part of the ruins that interested so many romantics. And a specific example of this is Henry Wordsworth's fantastic poem, Lines Composed a Few Miles Above Tintern Abbey. But what does all this have to do with the Wendigo? Well, Glenn, this is where I'm going to put you on the spot here and ask you to consider the ways in which the Wendigo might be engaging with the Romantic or Gothic tradition of literature. And specifically, you know, in what ways or in what terms can the sublime be applied to the virgin woods as well as the ruins of a decaying Gothic castle? In what ways are these sort of similar, if at all?
Yeah, Romanticism, we should say as well, is a pretty big umbrella term, and that there often are these subsets of Romanticism that people will really talk about, right? And that's where I think you and I have, yeah, made it somehow this far into the show and really into the network without ever really talking about Romanticism. And that's because the subset of Romanticism that we engage with a lot on the show is the Gothic movement. It's Gothicism, right? Which we have talked about a ton. But here in this story, I think that what we have principally is this other subset, or one of the other subsets of Romanticism, which is naturalism, right? And you know, scholars will treat this, you know, differently, or different scholars will treat this differently, sometimes thinking of naturalism as something that grows out of Romanticism and extends chronologically, you know, later than Romanticism or something like that. But I think that, you know, it's fair to say say that an intense interest in nature is a part of the Romantic movement, and that, you know, if we're going to think about Blackwood, or at least think about this story, the Wendigo, as a romantic story looking for this encounter with the sublime, then really, you know, it's this naturalist subset of romanticism that we seem to really have here. You know, I don't know how much we've got, you know, Sturm and Drang type, you know, characters like that. I don't think that there's a, you know, a Byron-esque hero here, or, you know, some kind of Beethoven figure or something, you know, here in this story, that we've certainly encountered those types of characters in other stories. This really is a story in which the main character, I think, is this wilderness, right? That's the principal character here. We get more descriptions of what the wilderness is like than we do about any of the actual people here, and even than we do of the actual, you know, the Wendigo either, right? The actual title of the story, you know, is barely described, barely interacted with compared with the setting, right? With the nature itself, which I would maintain really is the principal character in this story. And so for me, I think that's, you know, just off the bat, if we're going to start thinking about the ways in which Blackwood is engaging with romanticism or naturalism, interested in the sublime, it's really just to point out that the real object of his attention here is this wilderness.
I think that's exactly right. I want to read a little bit from Edmund Burke's The Sublime and Beautiful. This is section 3 of part 2 called Obscurity, where Burke is really looking at the sublime and its relationship to terror and fear. But obscurity here is a big part of that. And this is what Burke says. To make anything very terrible, obscurity seems in general to be necessary. When we know the full extent of any danger, when we can accustom our eyes to it, a great deal of the apprehension vanishes. Everyone will be sensible to this who considers how greatly night adds to our dread, and in all cases of danger, and how much the notions of ghosts and goblins, of which none can form clear ideas, affects minds, which gives credit to the popular tales concerning such sorts of beings. Those despotic governments, which are founded on the passions of men and principally upon the passions of fear, keep their chief as much as may be from the public eye. The policy has been the same in many cases of religion. Almost all the heathen temples were dark. Even in the barbarous temples of the Americans at this day, they keep their idol on a dark part of the hut, which is consecrated to his worship. For this purpose, too, the Druids performed all their ceremonies in the bosom of the darkest woods and in the shade of the oldest and most spreading oaks. And he goes on from there. But I think that this story, I mean, you could read the section on the sublime here, and particularly its relationship to terror and fear, you know, and get the same sort of thing that you get from Lovecraft's great essay about, you know, horror and supernatural literature. But I think this sense of obscurity, this feeling that we don't have the full picture, is something that's found both in a decaying castle or in ruins, and also in these woods. And I think Blackwood really captures the way in which being in the wilderness is an experience about the obscuring of the full picture, and can lead to this encounter with the sublime that we see so much of this story is caught up with.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think that one of the things that's going on here in terms of this wilderness experience and thinking about obscuring, right, is the way in which, you know, being in the wilderness obscures really the rest of the world, right? And that it is taking you out of your, well, really what is your natural environment as a civilized human, which is to say a human who lives in a city, or at least lives within a society that has cities, right? And obscures that, right? Takes you out of that environment, puts you in a different environment in a way that is really uncomfortable. I mean, that's really what people are going out for when they're, you know, going on hikes and so on, is to get away from what is the familiar, to get into something that doesn't feel quite right as a way of learning something about yourself, right? That's you know, I guess what people who are, you know, going hiking as a kind of, or undertaking hiking, or, you know, mountaineering, backpacking as a kind of spiritual pursuit, are doing something like that. And I think that we see that here in Blackwood's perspective on this as well.
I think so. And there is this kind of contrast in the story that we don't see too much of, really, in the last chapter, of the self as being in a natural state of nature, and the self as being part of a society. And a big part of DeFago's, I just said it like Hank says it in the story, a big part of DeFago's role in this story is to explore, I think, the degree to which individuation is healthy and the degree to which it can tip over into something else entirely. And maybe in this way, Blackwood is offering a critique of romanticism. So here's what he says at the end of the story about DeFago, and this is about individualism. This is when DeFago returns and they're talking about him a little bit. This time it was the real man, though incredibly and horribly shrunken. On his face was no expression of any kind whatever, fear, welcome, recognition. He did not seem to know who it was that embraced him, or who it was that fed and warmed and spoke to him the words of comfort and relief. Forlorn and broken beyond all reach of human aid, the little man did meekly as he was bidden. The something that had constituted him individual had vanished forever. And this to me seems to be a direct critique of the way in which romanticism really created the created the concept of the individual who can confront the gods and survive, right? The Promethean man, Lucifer in Milton's Paradise Lost, the way individuals maybe formed mobs or from the idea of a single leader were able to establish the monarchy, the divine right to rule, form their own colonies, say in the US, rebel against the British government. And that Blackwood is saying here that there are places in this world where if you go too deep into them, you can't be called back into humanity. And that is something to actually be concerned about. That is the way in which he is taking, I think, the naturalist side of romanticism and tipping it into horror. It's kind of his innovation here on the subject.
I wonder, though, if Blackwood would describe what he's doing as writing about the way in which the wilderness has done this to DeFago, or like the wilderness might do this, could do this to anybody. I do think that there's a lot of language in the story about that. But Blackwood is also constantly telling us about the traits of these characters, of the other characters here, and seems to be suggesting that some people are just more susceptible to this kind of thing, and possibly even presenting that as a kind of weakness, right? That's more, some people are just sensitive to the wilderness and maybe shouldn't go out because then they might be affected by this mania in some way, or, you know, become preyed upon by the Wendigo that seems to be seeking out people who are more sensitive than others. So I guess what I'm getting at here, Brandon, is that I do wonder about the extent to which Blackwood is laying the agency or giving the agency to something in the wilderness rather than saying that this is something innate in some people, but not innate in others, that there are, you know, differences within people. And in fact, he might even in some way be talking about the differences here along these scientific racist lines.
Well, you've predicted my next line of questioning here perfectly, which is, you know, if we're thinking about individualism, right, the individual, the something which makes you other from others, that can be erased. What is that something that Blackwood is talking about here? You know, because this story has this sort of deterministic point of view about the way that racial traits play into the development of an individual, of their being, the way that they're expressing racial traits. Every single character in this story, their race is commented upon. And, you know, Simpson has the Scots pluck. Punk is a quiet, you know, Indian who keeps to himself and can merge with the woods the way animals do. DeFago has this, you know, French-Canadian way of being a trapper or something like that. You know, there's something deep in the telling of the story about racism and racial traits. I guess one thing we could ask before diving into the role this plays in the story is, do you think this is Blackwood's beliefs? you know, that this is just a popular conceptualization of reality that he's absorbed, or are we dealing with a different authorial voice in the telling of this tale as a way to explain maybe the Cathcart's or the degree to which Cathcart and his, you know, psychological ilk, his peers may have influenced the telling of this story?
I think that this is Blackwood. I don't think that this story is meant to be a critique of scientific racism. And maybe we should do a little bit of defining of that, that we have done this in many other places. I think probably most, or well, at the greatest length, I guess, early in Peace, which we covered over on the Gene Wolfe Literary Podcast. It was probably the wrap-up episode for the discussion episode for chapter one of Peace. But at any rate, you know, scientific racism is a way of thinking about the world and the people who inhabit the world, thinking that the behaviors, the aptitudes, the skills, the talents, the characteristics of people are by and large hereditary, and that we can see that in deep antiquity, there was a bifurcation, which means two. So I guess furcation, we'll say, is splitting into many, groups of humanity, such that people can be grouped into different races that have these different characteristics, different attributes, skills, talents, aptitudes, etc. And then we can give them names. And this is a worldview. This is an ideology that people had throughout the 19th century and deep into the 20th century. And in fact, every single one of us involved in the podcast here, you and I making it, anyone who's listening to this, this is true of your grandparents. 100% true of your grandparents. They might not have thought about it in those terms, but probably without interrogating it very much, would have had a lot of this worldview as part of their own worldview, just in a kind of uninterrogated way, just thinking that this is what the world is like. You can see this all over art, all over literature, even by people who actually explicitly say they reject that ideology, which of course people were doing in droves following the Holocaust. I always like to point to Star Trek actually as the best example of that, where Gene Roddenberry and other Star Trek creators would have said that they explicitly reject scientific racism, but then it's all over the world they've built. And all over the attitudes of the characters that they're writing, because you just can't jettison the ideology that you're raised in, that easily. It's difficult to do. So anyway, that is maybe a broad primer on scientific racism before we can move on. But, by and large, the way that this is working here in the story, right, is that what Blackwood is saying is that, Defago is behaving a certain way because of his Latin characteristics, that he's got this Latin melancholy that makes him susceptible to this. And then we have, Puck has different characteristics that he has biologically inherited from his family that are the biological and spiritual characteristics of his race. And that this is true of Cathcart and Simpson as well. They have, that they're Celtic people, right? This is also what we saw happening in The Whore at Red Hook by Lovecraft last year, that Celtic people have a different set of attitudes, aptitudes, skills, talents, proclivities, and so on that are in some way hereditary as well. And that is the organizing scheme of the way that Blackwood is or characterizing the figures in the story, the characters in his story. And I don't think that it is a kind of critique of that. I think that for Blackwood, this is illuminating and explanatory, and that this is something that is right and correct about the world.
I think you're 100% right in saying that. I think this is Blackwood's beliefs, perhaps unexamined, on display here. And it really gets thorny, or maybe interesting, when you are dealing with somebody who is so deeply engaging purposefully with the concept of the sublime here in the story for the sake of the storytelling. And romanticism is aware of the role of the individual in this, and using somehow these racial traits to be the something that makes us individually individuals, right? That we as individuals express these traits with or without our conscious knowledge or harmony of consciousness, maybe, in expressing them. But at the end of the day, when that's taken away, when some trauma finally overtakes us, what we are left with is a blank slate of mind, is that we've lost our ability to express our racial traits ultimately. That's kind of one way to read what's happening to DeFago at the end of this story. That something that makes him an individual is his unique expression of the racial traits that he has. And when that's taken away, he's a blank slate and he will die, right? He has no identity.
Right. And Blackwood is, I think, leaning pretty hard into that, right? Something else that Blackwood is, I guess, if we're just, you know, giving labels to Blackwood, he's a romanticist, he's a scientific racist, but he's also this deep spiritualist, right? That he has a real profound belief in this spirit inside individuals, a kind of, you know, some kind of spark or breath, right? That's really what the word means, some kind of numinous breath that has imbued all of us with our individuality, our uniqueness, our personhood, and that if that goes, then our body will have to go with it. And that definitely is what happens to DeFago here. And that this is an attitude that we see not just in the way that Blackwood is writing about what happens to DeFago, but that this spiritualism is actually on display in the way that he's writing about the wilderness as well. I said earlier that he's writing about the wilderness really as the chief character of this story. And in that sense, the wilderness has its own spirit, right? That he's writing about the wilderness through this spiritualist lens as well, that it also has this numinous breath in it, you know, that gives it this spark, that gives it these characteristics, that gives it this identity and also this agency in the world.
Yeah, and that agency might be expressed through the Wendigo itself, as the Wendigo is some kind of expression, material expression of nature. And we get this in Simpson's own, I guess, perhaps reckoning with what he's encountered. I want to read a little bit here from again, the last chapter. Simpson, the student of divinity, it was, who arranged his conclusions probably with the best, though not most scientific, appearance of order. Out there, in the heart of unreclaimed wilderness, they had surely witnessed something crudely and essentially primitive. Something that had survived somehow the advance of humanity, had emerged terrifically, betraying the scale of life still monstrous and immature. He envisaged it rather as a glimpse into the prehistoric ages when superstitions, gigantic and uncouth, still oppressed the hearts of men, when the forces of nature were still untamed, the powers that may have haunted a primeval universe not yet withdrawn. To this day, he thinks of what he termed years later in a sermon, savage and formidable potencies lurking behind the souls of men. Not evil perhaps in themselves, yet instinctively hostile to humanity as it exists. And so here we have a Christian character, you know, dealing with some leftover from some old form of creation, not meant for the kind of world that we've inherited or that humanity has taken over. And there's a metaphysical belief in that, but there's also, I think, a core of this spirituality of the way in which humans are in the world or what we are meant to be in the world, and that we are maybe not the first sentient or sapient beings on the planet, but we are the sacred ones in some sense.
Well, I think that's a huge part of what Blackwood is up to here. I think that's a massive part of his worldview, right? Is thinking about what is sacred, and in particular, what is sacred about our experiences and about us that sets us sets us apart from what else is on the planet. And I think that's all over this story for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe we can even think of it in the way the text does, as these, you know, materialist versus non-materialist approaches. We read in our recap episode the way that Blackwood critiques materialism as a worldview that requires a lie in order to make sense of it, because there's so much beyond our experience that we maybe as a species have learned to carve out from any, you know, from our reality, that we often don't have to encounter things that would cause us to challenge a materialist worldview. And I wondered, Glenn, if you thought materialism versus spiritualism was the conflict here, or maybe rational versus irrational was the conflict that Blackwood had in mind in this sort of little exploration of these concepts that he puts in the text.
Yeah, this is a fantastic question. It is one that we will definitely have to revisit when we do get around to our series, our Patreon series on The Willows. I think here that I would lean against the dichotomy, the spiritual material dichotomy in this story, that I think that this is less about the Wendigo as a, you know, material embodiment of something than it is about the fact that there is something out in the world that we, or really our ancestors, have kind of carved away, or, you know, carved ourselves away from and cordoned off in some way. And that here is a group of people who are now out experiencing the wilderness in its full spiritual force and discovering that, you know, there is more to the world than they have dreamed of. And I think that this is something that we have seen elsewhere in Blackwood. It's also something that we have seen elsewhere in writers contemporary to Blackwood, these ideas about myths and legends, you know, containing kernels of truth about the world that we as enlightened, rational people have explained away as being metaphors or the representative of just unfounded fears of the dark, or, you know, that our ancestors had or something like that. But then the move here for Blackwood and his contemporaries is to say, no, these things are true. They contain kernels of truth. Here's a story about someone going out and actually experiencing that sort of thing. And I think we get, you know, some clues, maybe clues, not quite the right word, but indications of that attitude in the way that Blackwood is describing so much of the wilderness setting in these numinous terms. But when he's doing it several times, several places, he invokes other ways that people, himself included, are writing about this sort of thing. And I'm thinking specifically here of the way that he keeps bringing up fairies, as if the, you know, that this landscape has something to do with the way that Europeans talk about fairies, that there's some idea here that there are these hidden things that humans have trained themselves not to see, or that humans have isolated themselves from, but you can come out to the wilderness and find it again, experience it again.
Right. And that it's that kind of original state too, that return to the proper way of seeing that is such a big part of romanticism as well. The romanticism, I think, doesn't deal with fairies as much as, just sublimity, right? So yeah, let's consider the Wendigo. We keep on dancing around the monster in the text here. You know, I mentioned in our recap episode, Dr. Emily Zarka, who's a British romantic scholar at the University, Arizona State University, I should say, who had this like PBS web series. It might have aired on PBS, called Monstrum, who brought up the way that the Wendigo is typically interpreted throughout the Ojibwe language culture, right? The language cluster, the tribes that make up, or the nations that make up the Ojibwe language group, that it's, you know, about the encroachment of winter, hunger, and the selfishness and greed. And there's also a big part of Wendigo lore out there that has to do with cannibalism, right? That has to do with hunger and greed. Breaking that taboo was something that might have happened in periods of food scarcity, and that it might be have gotten blamed on the Wendigo. This is a big feature of the movie Ravenous. There's probably an episode of like Charmed or something about this. There's a second episode of Supernatural deals with the Wendigo. I'll say one other source that's dealing with Blackwood's Wendigo here is a truly terrible adaptation in the first Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark book by Alvin Schwartz. As a kid, you can't beat these books, but I'd rather have my kid read The Wendigo, I think, than Schwartz's retelling. I took a look at it. It's 3 pages. It's absolutely terrible. It's like a guy wanted to go to the woods to hunt, and he met a person named Defago, who was his guide, and then Defago heard something calling from him. It's just, it misses all the glory of this story. But how do you think the Wendigo is functioning in this text? Is it a mass hallucination brought on by some form of group trauma? Or is it a real monster that does require perhaps some explaining away?
Well, first I want to say I also have my copy of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark right next to me. And yeah, you're right. As an adaptation, it takes some real liberties. Though one thing it does is lean into the fire motif in some interesting ways, which I think we'll probably get to. So maybe we'll bring it back then. But I will say, you know, this was a big part of my childhood, this book. I don't know if it was for you, but like for me, this is grade school. It was published in 1981 and I would have been, you know, literate, you know, around 1985 or so, I guess. I certainly remember reading this book in, must have been 1987, and loving it. You know, this was actually something that our teacher even read to us. I don't remember specifically any of the stories that were read to us. So I want to believe that actually it was the Wendigo was one of the stories that she read to us in grade school. But yeah, I'm with you that it's not great as an adaptation, but I think it's actually pretty great for, you know, second graders, third graders, right? To get into horror stories. Yeah. So, and in fact, actually, this is probably something that we ought to cover someday. I don't know how we would do that, but it might be fun to take a look at this somehow. But at any rate, let's talk about the Wendigo, which is the real question that you have asked here. Yeah, look, what do I think the Wendigo is? This is actually the one place where I feel disappointed by Blackwood's story, which I hate to say because this is a masterpiece that I absolutely adore, but I find myself a little disappointed by the actual nature of the Wendigo. And I feel like it's okay to say that because I think that maybe everybody is, that, you know, all the adaptations of this, and there are, you know, there are many, even some that are just inspired by rather than adapted, do something different with the actual creature, with the actual Wendigo, than what Blackwood does. I mean, we were joking in the recap that this is maybe kind of a story about weird feet, which I just don't maybe find as unsettling as I could. But I guess really my source of disappointment here is that I want the Wendigo to either turn out to be some kind of perfectly mundane biological creature that simply hasn't been cataloged because we're out here in the wilderness and there aren't that many of them. And, you know, so this is a new kind of, you know, life form discovery. I would, you know, that's a kind of wilderness horror story that I, you know, am really, really into, or to have gone more monstrous, right? And I think that's the direction that most people go when they're adapting this story or taking inspiration from it. Certainly that is what Supernatural does. I also think that's what Peter Straub does in Ghost Story, which is very much taking its cue from the Wendigo here, of saying what's a monster in some kind of indigenous American folklore? And I'm going to dial that up to 11 and treat it as if it is part of the, you know, English language, English literature, horror tradition, and do that with it. And I think that, you know, reading backwards, right, from or encountering this story backwards in a culture where we are suffused with those types of stories, the actual revelation here about what the Wendigo is seems to lack some punches.
Yeah, I think, you know, why I was kind of joking about owls, not so much, but I brought it up a few times, is that I think I would be pretty frightened to discover something that looked like a person with like grotesque lizard bird feet, right? Like that's, I would be scared by that. Like that's what I envision the feet to be in this story, basically owl feet or like velociraptor feet or T-Rex feet as we see in Jurassic Park, you know, Spielberg's movie. But yeah, that's, it's not just the feet. Maybe this is a good segue. I mean, I think you're right to think that Blackwood should have done something more monstrous just to have real stakes in the story. You know, the stakes are pretty high. Maybe a good comparison to what I'm talking about here is the film Descent, which has characters in an already terrifying, naturally terrifying situation, and then the monsters raise the stakes of that terror. The Wendigo doesn't really raise the stakes of the terror here. It's more of a creature that allows us to maybe say this is a group hallucination, right? This is a trauma-induced hallucination. Somebody got lost, lost their bearings, lost their mental health in the woods, or their mental well-being, and it threw the whole hunting party off, and things got weird, right? And the monster is some kind of embodiment of that. Also, clearly, like, the winter here is important. And so, yeah, let's return to the feet here, because it's not just that they're weird-looking feet. It's that they're the fire here is a constant part of what's happening. There's a fire in this part of the island that a lot of the woods are burned. The monster has burning feet. Fire's brought up as a motif a lot, and this seems to me to be a natural contrast with winter. So I guess my question here with these motifs, Glenn, is are they meant to be put in contrast in the text, or is fire just a natural part of survival in the wilderness and the Wendigo is maybe this threat of winter and there's no contrast here at all? They just happen to be two motifs in the story.
This is one of the things that I really, really appreciate about this story. I have said many places on the network that I love backpacking. I haven't gotten to do very much of it, in fact, any of it since becoming a parent, but it is my number one hobby. It's something I love to do. My copy of this book that is, you know, here on the desk next to me is pretty wrecked because I, for a long time, carried it with me on every backpacking trip. It is stuffed full of backcountry permit slips and all sorts of other things that I was using as bookmarks. It's become kind of a collection. And I have, you know, gone into the Canadian wilderness by myself and read exactly this story, which actually I don't recommend to people if you're trying to get a good night's sleep. Not actually a good plan. But yeah, I absolutely love this story and I love backpacking, right? And so one of the things that really jumped out to me on this read is how much the fire really matters, because I don't ever light a fire when I go backpacking. I bring, you know, fire starting equipment with me in case of an emergency, but I don't ever need it. That I don't need it for warmth because I have really good gear that a person couldn't have had when Blackwood wrote this story. And I don't need it for food because I can bring food with me in ways that would not have been possible for this hunting group. This group was going to need to cook their own food on this expedition, that they weren't going to be able to bring all their supplies with them in the form of dehydrated food or, you know, food full of preservatives that will keep it from decomposing, right, while they're on their expedition. And so that is a place where the experience that this group is having is very different from my own experience, where I never have to light a fire. I never feel like there's, you know, if I can't get a fire lit, there's some risk. I don't encounter fire when I'm out backpacking like this. But for these people, for this story, the fire is life. That the fire is crucial. They need it to stay warm. They need it to prepare their food. And so coupling the horror with this life-sustaining element, you know, I think that actually amplifies the horror here for Blackwood's contemporary readers in ways that I have probably missed almost every time that I have read this story.
I think that's a really fascinating approach to the way fire is used in this story, that it is what sustains life in the wilderness for humans. But then for the monster to appropriate this characteristic, right, or to in some ways be the originator of it, or to be the representative of the ways in which fire is also a threat to the wilderness itself, is a fascinating approach to the motif of fire in this story that I hadn't considered. Before we get to favorite passages here, Glenn, I'm not going to read any. I read so much of this book already into the mic, so that's going to be on you. I do want to say, do you have any critiques of this story besides Blackwood's kind of undeveloped use of the Wendigo in you know, ways we've mentioned? For me, he just totally whiffs it with Punk. It's just a huge whiff. It's just an absolutely missed opportunity of storytelling. That's what I feel like the story needed, was you have somebody who has this perspective and the story ends with Punk's knowledge of the Wendigo kind of capping this tale that says this was real. But otherwise it's just a big whiff. Any other critiques on your end for the tale?
Yeah, I think that's really part of the type of critique that I was offering up as well. I do think that it just generally speaking feels like the monster itself is a bit lackluster in this monster story, and that our expectations of what this monster story or this type of monster story should be like are, you know, influenced by having experienced loads of things that have been inspired by this and then done it differently. And one of those is, let's actually engage with the indigenous folklore and have that folklore be revelatory or explanatory and helpful and useful in some way, which is exactly what happens in Ghost Story, although still maybe not quite dialed up as far as, you know, you were wanting it to be dialed up in the Wendigo here. But yeah, I mean, I share that criticism, though I do also quite like what he does with Punk, which is, again, to engage in this scientific racism where, or, you know, the scientific racist worldview in which he thinks that, believes that people's attitudes, characteristics, aptitudes, abilities, talents, etc., are informed by their heredity, that they've inherited something, some approach to engaging with, well, with the world, but in this case, specifically engaging with the wilderness. And for Punk, it's the sensibility to just get the heck out of here. Yeah. Like, he doesn't have to exist in the story because, you know, these other races don't belong here. They don't know how to handle it, right? But he does. As soon as there's an indication that Wendigo business is happening, he just leaves. Just, I'm out of here. I'm not going to engage with this.
Yeah, he says, I'm not going to be eaten. You're not going to do anything to my feet. And then he just leaves, you know, leaves town or whatever. It is a great moment in this story, you know. It's also because he's like, he's literally the reason why they're able to have a good camping trip in the first place. You know, he's doing all the campsite work. He's doing all the labor that allows them to, you know, come home or come to the site after a disappointing day and warm their feet by the fire. And, you know, there's even this line where Hank's like, it's not Christian for us to leave Punk back there while we're warming our feet by the fire. Let's bring him into the circle here. And it's hilarious. I mean, there's a huge history of Christianity, evangelical Christianity, and their engagement with indigenous peoples and First Nations peoples in this country. I don't think that's what Blackwood is tugging on, but it sparked some interest to me that there's this cultural Christianity, perhaps, or nominal Christianity, that underscores Blackwood's worldview here as well, even though he had a kind of a broader spiritual scope of being. But now it's up to you, Glenn, to kind of bring us to the end of the show, unless there's anything else you want to talk about, by reading out some of your favorite passages into the mic.
Yeah, I am actually going to just read one, but I will say that I've made a big rookie mistake here, which is that I have a dozen or so of them marked with sticky notes here in my copy of the book, and I, you know, hadn't picked out one in particular to read. I was kind of just going to pick one at random. Here's the mistake that I made, which is that you read several of them in the recap episode, and I did not remove my sticky notes. But, you know, the sticky notes are just kind of like appended to a particular paragraph. And so I may wander into some overlap here. We'll see.
We do this often, though. We reread passages all the time. It's no big deal.
Well, here's what I'll read. The dusk rapidly deepened. The glades grew dark. The crackling of the fire and the wash of little waves along the rocky lakeshore were the only sounds audible. The wind had dropped with the sun, and in all the vast world of branches, nothing stirred. Any moment, it seemed, the woodland gods, who are to be worshipped in silence and loneliness, might sketch their mighty and terrific outlines among the trees. In front, through doorways pillared by huge, straight stems, lay the stretch of 50 Island Water, a crescent-shaped lake some 15 miles from tip to tip, and perhaps 5 miles across where they were camped. A sky of rose and saffron, more clear than any atmosphere Simpson had ever known, still dropped its pale, streaming fires across the waves, where the islands, 100 surely rather than 50, floated like the fairy barks of some enchanted fleet. Fringed with pines, whose crests fingered most delicately the sky, they almost seemed to move upwards as the light faded, about to weigh anchor and navigate the pathways of the heavens instead of the currents of their native and desolate lake. And of course, this goes on and on. But what I really, really love about this is that at its core, what this is a description of is the sunset as Simpson is making camp here. Simpson and DeFago, I should say, are making camp here. And Simpson is watching the last light of the sun on the lake here, and we get some fire imagery in the way that that's described. But there are also three, at least, I mean, I'm counting here, three supernatural allusions here, or references here, or metaphors here in the way that he's explaining this, talking about woodland gods who are to be worshipped in silence and loneliness, that the islands look like ferry boats, some enchanted fleet out here. And then we also get the idea that there's going to be, some kind of navigating the pathways of the heavens here as well with these boats, right? So the whole way that Simpson is experiencing this is through thinking about this in supernatural or numinous terms. And then we also get the fire imagery here. I mean, this is exactly the type of descriptive writing you were talking about in the recap episode when you said you really love the descriptive writing here, because it is all in service of the mood and all in service of these motifs. And this is, I think, a great example of it.
It's the best passage in the story, I think. It's such a beautifully rendered passage. The visuals are on point, and yeah, everything is serving the bigger ideas that Blackwood has in mind here. And it's just a magnificent chunk of writing. I'm glad you didn't read a passage about the horror of Defago's footprints in the snow as they change. I don't know. Maybe that would have been all right too. Who knows? But I think we're at the end of the episode here. So once again, I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. You can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. While you are on the internet going to websites, we also hope that you will go over to Patreon and join us. That's patreon.com/claytemplemedia. As we said at the top of the show, you will gain access to a lot of episodes about some really, really great stories that we have covered over there. But also, you will get to vote for next year's stories. Only really a week or so left in the first round of voting for next year's stories. Though there will be more rounds if you're catching this late. Next time, we're going to be back with something I'm really, really excited about. This is the Trail of Cthulhu supplement, Book Hounds of London, written by Kenneth Haidt. And until then, we greet you and say farewell.